everybody. As Christians, we have, you might say, many topics, many subjects, many goals to study into or to ponder. For example, just one would be the resurrection. You know, it's such a mind-bending idea to think about. It's true, it's going to come to pass, but it gives us something to pause, to consider, to meditate about. Another thing that we have would be the idea of actually being with God the Father and Jesus Christ. It's just, you know, hard to fathom it, but it's something else that's going to come, and God wants us to think about these things. Another thing would be the act of being recruited by God into a force, a group to help teach God's ways to the people of the world. That's coming someday in the future. It'll come. And another thing that we think about is the idea of living for eternity. You know, that's, or even understanding eternity into the past, things like that that we'll eventually come to grasp. There are many scriptures that cover these topics and gives us much food for thought, for meditation. Now, of all of the different topics, and there's many, many more that you can all think of, many of them, the common denominator in everything that we look into in our spiritual lives is that everything depends on our salvation. That's the common denominator. Without salvation, none of the things in the future that we can consider will ever come to pass for us. You know, if we don't have salvation, you just forget about anything else. Paul kind of talked about this in a similar way in 1 Corinthians 15 when he used the word resurrection. But, of course, if you're in the resurrection, you've received salvation at that moment, too. And you remember his words, you know, if there is no resurrection, just to paraphrase him, forget it. Everything we do is in vain. And so we do have this common denominator, the salvation that God is going to give us, that's going to enable us to go on from the end of our human life to life eternal as spirit beings. Now, we sometimes express this concept of salvation in various ways, various words and expressions. We talk about getting salvation or receiving it, or we are given salvation. We can express that many different ways depending on how we want to emphasize certain things. We can use a word that comes from salvation, saved. You know, when we receive salvation, we say we will be saved. There's other words too. The dictionary defines salvation in kind of a general way as redemption. Now, theologically, redemption is a little bit different than salvation, although they're very similar. The dictionary says salvation is deliverance from sin and its penalties, and it certainly is. I looked up Roger's Thesaurus. I haven't opened that book in years. And in there they give words that are synonyms for salvation. They use the word reclamation, restoration, preservation. We don't use those too much in the theological sense, but there's many different words that we can use that mean salvation. Now, these terms all apply to the concept of salvation. And if I were to ask each person in this room to write down, what is your particular concept of salvation, we'd all come up with different answers, but they would all be related, and they would all tie back into Scripture. Because salvation means something different to each person, to how you take it personally. But if you turn over to 1 Peter, the fourth chapter, in 1 Peter 4, a different aspect of salvation is being addressed here. And I'm going to read 1 Peter chapter 4. I'm just going to read two verses here, verses 17 and 18. Peter, of course, was writing this, and he says in verse 17, "For the time has come that judgment must begin at the house of God. And if it first begins at us, what shall be the end of them that do not obey the gospel of God?" He's asking a question here. And then he says something strange in verse 18. "If the righteous scarcely be saved, where shall the ungodly and the sinner appear?" Now, what did he mean by that? If the righteous scarcely be saved. Now, I'm reading this in the King James Version. But I looked at the New King James. I even looked at a Greek interlinear version. They all use the word scarcely. If the righteous scarcely are saved, what does that mean? Are we going to just be saved by the, you know, the end of our fingertips hanging on a cliff? And if we are, if that's the case with us, where shall the ungodly and the sinner appear? This verse alone right here would make a good verse for somebody to come up with the idea that we're just barely going to make it and forget about everybody else. You know, where would they be if we just barely make it? But is that what it means? Or what exactly does it mean? Well, this verse, verse 18, when understood properly, tells us an awful lot about God's salvation, his true salvation. But due to one word in this verse, this whole verse can be greatly misunderstood. Now, we'll get to that a little bit later, what that word is. This verse 18, incidentally, comes in a general way from a Proverbs verse. It's verse 31 of Proverbs 11. King James version of Proverbs 11:31 says, "Behold, the righteous shall be recompensed in the earth, much more the wicked and the sinners." Now, how do we take that? Well, the New King James changes it slightly and says, "If, not behold, but if the righteous will be recompensed in the earth, how much more the wicked and the sinner," or the ungodly and the sinner, it says. And there's a footnote in my New King James that says, "If the righteous will be, rather than recompensed, rewarded." Now, if you just take that idea, that's a concept that made its way into the New Testament here in verse 18 that we looked at. But what about that? The Old Testament Proverbs writer was saying, if the righteous are being rewarded, how much more will the wicked and the sinners be rewarded? Well, that's kind of confusing, too. That kind of makes it sound like the wicked and the sinners will be rewarded more than the righteous. So what's the answer to that? To the idea of the righteous in conjunction with this word scarcely, like we saw in verse 18, if the righteous scarcely be saved, that idea of the righteous and the word scarcely in conjunction with each other is written again, and this time by Paul. This one we looked at was Peter, but Paul wrote one in Romans. If we turn over to Romans 5, see what Paul wrote. He uses these same two words, the righteous and scarcely, in conjunction with each other. Romans 5 and verse 7. He says here, "For scarcely for a righteous man will one die. Yet peradventure for a good man some would even dare to die." Now, what does that mean? That's kind of confusing too. Scarcely for a righteous man would one die, but maybe for a good man some would even dare to die. Does that mean that there's a difference between a righteous man and a good man? It seems to add to the confusion. Is it saying a good man is worth dying for more than a righteous man? What exactly does that mean? Well, today what I'm going to do is examine the key to understanding these two verses, the one here in Romans that I read and the one in 1 Peter. The key to the meaning of both of these verses is the meaning of that word, scarcely. Once we understand what that word scarcely really means, the verses take on a very, very clear significance. And in the process of looking into this, we'll see that the scriptures in question have a lot to say about God's salvation, and that it really is not a confusing thing. It's really, really good news. And it all has to do with the understanding of that word scarcely. Now, in both of the scriptures that we looked at, the word scarcely came from a Greek word pronounced molis, just a simple word, M-O-L-I-S, molis. A couple of them, the word mogus, with a G instead of an L, is used, and apparently from one of the commentaries I read, this word molis or mogus have been used interchangeably since the days of Homer, who lived back in the 700 BCs. So it's two words that, spelled slightly different, mean the same thing. Kind of, I was trying to think of two English words that are like that, and I thought, well, maybe and perchance, or perchance and happenstance, or perchance and peradventure. You know, we have words that mean the same thing, but they're written kind of differently. Well, that's the case with molus and mogus. I'm only going to mention this word a couple times throughout the sermon, because the Greek word itself doesn't mean anything to us, but when I mention it, I will use the L and call it molus. These two words, molus and mogus, are used in the New Testament seven different places. Of course, we saw where it was used by Paul. We saw where it was used by Peter. It's also used by Luke in his gospel. Now, the English words used to translate that word molus, we have a number of different words just in the three translations I looked at, the King James, the New King James, and the Greek. It was Green's Greek Interlinear. And I wrote down the frequency of here of these words. The word scarce or scarcely, related words, are used to translate it 9 times. So that's the most common translation. 7 times, however, it's translated hardly. And maybe if you have a different translation than King James or New King James, you might have hardly written down for that. 4 times it's translated either with difficulty or with great difficulty. 1 time it's translated with much work, and 1 other time with pain. So you can see this word can have a wide range of meanings. So let's examine some of the other scriptures that use this word molus to get a better grip on what it means. Now, the first place I want to go to is the book of Acts and the 27th chapter. Now, to give a background before we start reading here, in the 27th chapter, Paul was being held prisoner by the authorities. He had been questioned, interrogated, interviewed, you might say, by Felix, and then again by Festus, and then by King Agrippa. And Paul had, because he knew that he had this right since he was a Roman citizen, he had appealed to Rome, to Caesar, for his the charges that they were bringing against him. And so because of that, he was in the process here in chapter 27 of being shipped from Caesarea, where he was being interrogated by King Agrippa, to Rome, where he would appear before Caesar or else Caesar's representative. And, of course, he was going by ship. Now, in Acts 27 and in verse 7, we see that he has been put on a ship. And when we had sailed, he said, slowly many days, and scarce were come over against Cnidus, the wind not suffering us, we sailed under Crete, over against Salmone. Okay, now just focus in on the word scarce. We had scarce or scarcely come over against Cnidus. Does that mean they had almost gotten there? Or did it mean they just got there by the skin of their teeth? What else did it mean? Well, let's go on and read verse 8. This word molus appears here also. And hardly, that's the word molus. It was in King James, it was translated scarce, the verse before that. But now it says, hardly passing it, we came to a place which is called the Fair Havens, nigh whereunto was the city of Lasea. Okay, so here's two expressions using the same word. We scarce came there, and then we hardly passed it. Now, it obviously took a lot of work. Remember some of the words that are used to translate this word molus. We have hardly, we have with much work, with much effort, or diligently. And that's the sense that's being used here. They obviously did get there. They obviously, in verse 7, did come over against this Cnidus, this town, and they obviously passed it. But what is being implied by the use of the word molus here, by Paul in this case, is though it took work and though it took effort, they did indeed make it. Okay? So we, in a modern English translation, we could have said, well, we finally did come over against Cnidus, even though it took a lot of effort on our part. Same thing with passing it. It took a lot of work, but we passed it. It wasn't written, in other words, in the sense that they just barely made it. That's not what scarce or hardly meant. They did make it, but they did it with much difficulty. So that's one example of how this word can affect the discussion. And Paul used it to mean that Yeah, we had to put a lot of effort into it before we finally got past it and finally did what we wanted to do. Now, if we look here just down a little bit further in chapter 27, we see it used again, and I'll start reading in verse 14. Now, he's still on the ship, and he still hasn't gotten to Rome yet. He still has a long way to go, but it says, "But not long after there arose against it, against their ship, a tempestuous wind called Euryclidon." You know, they had names for winds. We have that today out in California, El Nino and El Niña. We call the winds by a name. And this was the name of this wind. "And when the ship was caught and could not bear up into the wind, we let it drive." Okay, they just left off any effort of trying to steer it. They just let it go where it would. "And running under a certain island, which is called Clauda, we had much work to come by the boat." Now here, "much work" in King James is this word molus again. We had a lot of work to come by the boat. And then they have a long technical, he has a long technical thing here in verse 17 telling what they did to the boat, "which when they had taken up, they used helps, undergirding the ship and fearing lest they should fall into the quicksand, strake sail and were so driven." If you read several other translations, you get a more total idea of what they were doing. They were putting some sort of things on this boat to make it easier for them to sail. And that's an interesting thing right there, just to read it in different translations to see how the different ideas there were in translating. But again, the overall reason why I'm quoting this, this word molus, once again, here in verse 16, means that it took a lot of work. But it doesn't mean that they just barely or just didn't quite get it done. They did. They got it done. But it took a lot of effort. Once again, that's the idea behind molus. Now, let's go to Acts 14 for the next example. Acts 14, and here in verse 8, I'm going to start reading here. "There sat a certain man at Lystra, impotent in his feet, being a cripple from his mother's womb, who had never walked. The same one heard Paul speak, who steadfastly beholding him and perceiving that he had faith to be healed, said with a loud voice," Paul said to this man, "stand upright on your feet," and he leaped and walked. You know, that would have been, can you imagine being in the crowd there and witnessing that? This man who everybody knew could not walk, he was born that way, and to have a man like Paul stand up with a voice of authority, say, "stand up and walk." "When the people saw what Paul had done, they lifted up their voices, saying in the speech of Lyonia, 'The gods are come down to us in the likeness of men.'" It was such a startling thing to see this man healed that they thought Paul and Barnabas were gods. Now, it goes on to say, they called Barnabas Jupiter, and Paul they called Mercury, because he was the chief speaker. Seems kind of backwards, doesn't it? Shouldn't the chief one be Jupiter? But anyway, these people were calling them gods because this is all they knew. They had the Roman pagan gods and that system. "Then the priest of Jupiter," there was a priest there who actually was a priest, and he served their pagan god Jupiter, "which was before their city, brought oxen and garlands under the gates, and he would have done sacrifice with the people for Barnabas and Paul, thinking they were gods. Which, when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard of it, they rent their clothes and they ran in among the people, crying out, yelling at them, saying, 'Sirs, why do you do these things? We also are men of like passions with you.'" We're men, we're not gods. "We preach unto you that you should turn from these vanities unto the living God, which made heaven and earth and the sea and all things that are therein, who in times past suffered all nations to walk in their own ways. Nevertheless, he left not himself without witness, in that he did good and gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness." You get the feeling that they were just going on and on and on, trying to convince these people that, no, God, the Father, the one we worship, is who gives you all this, not us. And then it concludes in verse 18 with, once again, that word molus in here. This time, King James translates it scarce. "With these sayings, scarce restrained they the people, that they had not done sacrifice unto them. Now, scarce, what does it mean there? This does not imply that they just barely restrained the people from worshiping them, but they accomplished it. They actually accomplished getting the message to these people that they should not be worshiping them. But it took a lot of effort to do that. That's what this word scarce in the King James means. They scarce restrained the people. Paul and Barnabas both did a lot of fast talking. They put forth a lot of effort to get the people restrained. You notice what it says here. It wasn't just Paul talking. It says they rent their clothes. They ran in among the people. They cried out and spoke. So you can picture Paul going in one direction, Barnabas in another direction, saying, you know, we worship God the Father. He's the one that's done all these things. And they each probably gave quite a bit of a sermon there to get these people to realize that they should not be worshiping them. So they scarce restrained them, meaning they did restrain them, but with a lot of difficulty, a lot of effort. Okay, so we seem to be following a theme here. This word molus, you get the feeling of what it means. It means, you know, it takes a lot of effort, it takes a lot of difficulty, it takes a lot of work, whatever they're talking about. Let's go to the book of Luke now. Remember I said the book of Luke has this word in it also. And this would be in Luke 9. Luke 9 and verse 37 is where I'll start here. It came to pass that on the next day, when they were come down from the hill, many people met him. This is talking about Jesus now. He's with his disciples. Many people come out to see him. Behold, a man of the company cried out, saying, Master, I beseech you, look upon my son, for he is my only child. And the reason why is in verse 39. And he says, lo, a spirit takes him. And he suddenly cries out, and it tears him, that he foams again. One translation says that he foams from the mouth when the spirit grabs him. And bruising him, says, hardly departs from him. Hardly there. That's the word molus. He hardly departs from him. Does that mean he doesn't quite depart? Well, from our experience with this word, no, it means he did depart, but it took some work to get this spirit out. Now, this time, according to the one reference book I have, I'll give you the name of it, it's called Thayer's Lexicon. They go into very, very much detail in Greek words. And according to Thayer's Lexicon, the word molus has a different, slightly different connotation in this case. Hardly here means that the spirit did depart from him, but only after much difficulty and also with much pain. If you remember the list of words that I said that word molus has been translated into in various translations, in this case, the idea was that child suffered pain. You know, the father was concerned about it because, as it says there, this spirit would take a hold of this child, and what does it say? It took him, and the child would suddenly start crying out, screaming. You can imagine the child was, just terrified, and it tore him in such a way that he was foaming at the mouth. I mean, this was terrible, and he bruised him. The spirit bruised this poor child, and then with a lot of pain involved in the child, it departed from him. So there you see, once again, that the word molus, even though in this case it's implying that there was a lot of pain involved, it doesn't mean that he just barely departed, or maybe almost departed, but it means he actually did depart accompanied by lots of pain. Okay, now, that covers the different places where this word molus is used other than the first two that we talked about. So let's go back to the first two scriptures that we talked about. Let's see if we can understand them a little bit better having this background. We'll go back first of all to Romans 5. Romans 5 and verse 7. Remember it says, for scarcely for a righteous man will one die, yet peradventure for a good man some would even dare to die. Here the word scarcely in this verse, according to Thayer's lexicon, again, has a different shade of meaning than the other places that we've looked at. Remember, most of them we're talking about with difficulty, with effort, in that one case with pain. But here in this one place, it has a meaning which the word molus can encompass and makes more sense when you realize that in this case it means very rarely. See, it has nothing to do with pain or effort. Once again, it says scarcely. We could say very rarely will one die for a righteous man. That makes more sense. That makes more sense because what it's saying here is that doesn't happen very often. And it wouldn't make sense to say that with a lot of effort would one die for a righteous man, but it makes more sense to say very rarely does that happen, and that is one of the meanings of molus. Now, we also have to look at something else, the difference between a righteous man and a good man. What is the difference between those two? Well, if you look into it, the righteous man, the word righteous here, and I'll read what the lexicons say about this. This word that was translated as a righteous man has the meaning of an individual who observes divine and human laws. That would make him righteous. It's one who, as such, ought to be called upright. Okay, this is somebody who is, in our eyes, would be called a man of God. Some of the different words to describe this would be upright, righteous, virtuous, keeping the commands of God. And that's what it's saying when it says it would be a rare thing for somebody to die for a man like that. It would be a rare thing because how often does somebody even want to die for anybody? But he's saying it would be a rare thing for that to happen. Yet, now when it talks about the good man, this is a much more general term. The word means good in the sense that anybody who excels in any respect could be called good or distinguished or a man of respect, but it has nothing to do with spiritual aspects like the word righteous does. And in fact, this word used for good can apply in the Greek to people, to things, to conditions, to qualities. What we're seeing here is Paul writing and saying, he's talking first of all about the righteous man. The good man is simply the same person. He's referring back to him by using the word good. So we could paraphrase this whole verse by saying, it's a rare thing that one would die for a righteous man, and yet perhaps some would even dare to die. It's all depending on how we emphasize this, in other words. If we emphasize it with the word righteous and good, we get, for scarcely, for a righteous man would one die, and yet peradventure for a good man, maybe some would even dare to die. Well, that's not the right translation. If I emphasize it this way, though, for scarcely for a righteous man, one might die, but maybe for a good man, some even would dare to die. You see, what he's saying is, you don't see it very often, but maybe you do sometimes. And that's all it's saying. It's not passing judgment on the difference between a righteous man and a good man. It's just saying that, you know, rarely do you see this, but occasionally I guess you could. That's all he's saying. So that's the understanding of this Romans 5:7. Now, let's take a look at the other verse that we started out with, 1 Peter 4. And we have a lot of background now to understand this word molus. And remember, that last one was the only place in where molus is used in the scriptures where it can be translated as it's rare. Every other place talks about difficulty or something that's hard to do. So let's go back to 1 Peter 4 and verse 17 again. And he's leading into it. He says, for a time, the time has come for judgment to begin at the house of God. That's us, okay? That's all the people who are called by God. And we know that judgment has come to us now. That this is our time of being judged. The rest of the world hasn't received their calling yet. So it says, if it first begins at us, What shall be the end of them that obey not the gospel of God? And then verse 18, let's look at that now. And if the righteous scarcely be saved, where shall the ungodly and the sinner appear? Now we know what scarcely means. It doesn't mean by the skin of our teeth. It means that the righteous with great difficulty are saved. And where is the great difficulty? Well, it's our effort that we have to expend once we're called, monitoring ourselves, our behavior, and everything that we do. We see different aspects of this in Scripture. Paul's admonition, you know the Scriptures where he says we're running a race. Let's not quit. Let's run the race and finish. That takes effort. And that means if the righteous with that kind of effort are saved. In Hebrews 12 and verse 3, the writer there describes the great difficulty, the much work, even sometimes pain, that we have to expend in order to meet God's qualifications. Paul in 1 Corinthians 9, for example, said he brought his body into subjection constantly. A lot of effort has to be expended. So now, the first part of verse 18, if we understand it as if the righteous with a lot of effort are saved, where shall the ungodly and the sinner appear? Well, you see, now we're not saying that the righteous just barely made it and the ungodly can't possibly do it. Now we're saying if the righteous with a lot of effort are saved, where shall the ungodly and the sinner appear? Well, the answer is in a later resurrection. That's where they'll appear. You know, he does ask a question, and the question has an answer. In the second resurrection, when the vast majority of people will be resurrected. He says in verse 19, a word of encouragement here, wherefore, let them that suffer according to the will of God commit the keeping of their souls to him in well-doing as unto a faithful creator. He uses the word suffer. And, you know, people do suffer. Let me just read the scripture that I alluded to in Hebrews 12, talking about how much effort is required by God for his people. Not that, and you know, let me put this disclaimer in, not that we earn salvation. We certainly don't. You know, God is under no edict to give us salvation just because of what we do. We receive salvation because of what Jesus did and our acceptance of that. But listen here in Hebrews 12, and starting in verse 3, and I'll read through verse 13. Consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, talking about Jesus, of course, lest you be wearied and faint in your minds. You have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin. And you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks unto you as unto children. My son, despise not the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when you are rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and scourges every son whom he receives. You know, that's not pleasant, but it's something that with effort we go through. Verse 7, if you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the Father does not chasten or discipline? For if you be without chastisement, whereof all are partakers, then you are bastards and not sons. Furthermore, we have had fathers of our flesh which corrected us, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection unto the Father of spirits and live? For they verily for a few days chastened us after their own pleasure. But he, God, the Father, chastens us for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness. Now, no chastening for the present seems to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. Wherefore, lift up the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way, but let it rather be healed. And so you can see from the words of whoever wrote Hebrews there, this salvation that we're pointing toward, that our goal is, does require lots of effort. And that's what Peter meant in verse 18 there, chapter 4 when he wrote, if the righteous with a lot of effort are saved, where are the ungodly and the sinner going to appear? Well, they're going to appear later, and they will have to do the same thing we're doing. With lots of effort, they will have to show God that they want that salvation which he has offered for us. So it kind of, when you understand the true meaning of these verses, when you understand what this word scarcely translated from molus means, it kind of negates the idea that once saved, always saved. It kind of negates the idea that all you have to do to be saved is sign your name on a line, give your heart to the Lord, and then let him do everything. That's not what the scriptures say. This word molus talks about how hard the work is in order to be successful. So in conclusion, here's the best part of this whole study. Here's the best part. That verse 18 doesn't tell us that the righteous are just barely going to be saved, and as a result, it doesn't tell us that the ungodly are lost forever, but what it does tell us is that by hard work and following what God expects of us, we will be saved. That's the positive of that. You look at that verse and you think, oh, isn't that negative if the righteous scarcely be saved? No, he's telling us if the righteous by much effort are going to be saved, then he asks the question, where are the others going to be? And we answered that question. And so this is a positive statement here. It tells us that if we do what we should be doing and we know what we should be doing, we will be saved with no doubt. Now, I had mentioned about Proverbs 11:31, and we can see what this means also. Because the righteous will be rewarded, remember it said the righteous will be rewarded, more so will the ungodly be rewarded? Well, what this is saying is the righteous will be rewarded. Moreover, the ungodly will also be rewarded. And it has to go in that order. The righteous have to be rewarded first in order for the sinners and the ungodly to have a chance. So a lot of this, you know, it depends on the order in which God is doing it, but it depends on us meeting what God wants us to do, meeting that challenge and being successful, because he wants to use us to bring the idea of salvation to the rest of the world. So that's the study of the word molus. Hopefully, when you read those scriptures now, they're less confusing, but less confusing in a way that gives us a much more positive outlook on things. God's telling us, you're not going to make it by the skin of your teeth. You're not going to be hanging on a cliff when Jesus comes and you say, oh, man, I couldn't hold on any longer. No, he's telling us, if we meet God's demands, God's laws, God's rules, if we meet those, we definitely will be receiving salvation when his son returns.